Case number 24-7050 et al. Stacia Hall et al. Appellants versus District of Columbia Board of Elections. Mr. Hayek for the appellants, Mr. Leach for the appellee.
Hey, Mr. Hayek, you may proceed when you're ready.
Your Honor, may it please the court, Chris Hayek for plaintiff's appellants. I would like to begin by briefly discussing the stakes of this case. It might not seem a big deal if a few hundred aliens vote in D.C. and maybe never affect the outcome of an election. But if there is nothing wrong constitutionally with this law, there would be nothing wrong if, say, California let aliens, including illegal aliens, vote in statewide elections, even federal elections. States, after all, have the right to determine voter qualifications in federal elections, though they can't do it in a way that violates constitutional rights. Whether good or bad, such an action by California would certainly be consequential, and the scenario is not terribly far-fetched. If this court says there's no constitutional right violated by letting aliens vote, they might try it.
Is this case based on the election of November 5, 2024?
Is this case what?
Based on the election of November 5, 2024.
Based on that is also based on upcoming elections, imminent harm. The question on the merits here is simply this. Do the people, meaning U.S. citizens, and the Supreme Court has rightly equated the two in this context, have a constitutional right to govern themselves? It seems axiomatic that they do, and the Supreme Court has stated this axiom in holdings. The right to citizen self-government is logically implied by the nature and presuppositions of the Constitution. By its nature, the Constitution is a blueprint for a democratic republic and thus presupposes the basic theory of democratic self-rule. For the Supreme Court, obvious consequences of this basic theory are that citizens comprise the self in self-government, that aliens, by definition, are not part of the self-governing body politic, that the people have the right to be governed by their citizen peers, and that the right to govern, and thus the right to vote, because that's how the people govern themselves, is reserved to citizens.
I wonder if you might focus also that the threshold on the standing point that the district court, that it was dispositive in the district court, the theory for standing.
Yes, on standing, there is clearly an injury here to every plaintiff because the right to citizen self-government has been violated, and their power, each plaintiff's power of citizen self-government has been reduced, if only fractionally, at this time.
So one thing that would be helpful, it's not entirely clear to me whether the harm from the distinct citizen self-government theory is any different from the vote dilution harm. In your, I guess it was in the reply brief, you talked about a harm of having to vote alongside non-citizens.
Right. That is a violation of the right to vote in an election in which only citizens vote.
Is that an associational claim, or is it just because one could, for example, if one thought that the vote dilution was a harm, and there are, you know, questions about that, but if it were, then that harm would presumably support standing to raise the claim of citizen self-government. But I was taking you to be also suggesting some other harm, injury in fact, as a basis for standing.
Right. The violation of the right to citizen self-government here travel or proceeds through vote dilution. It's the same thing in the sense that your vote is your power of citizen self-government is diluted because citizens share the votes.
So it does. You put it nicely. It proceeds through. So for purposes of standing, we're looking at a vote dilution theory. And typically, when the Supreme Court or courts of appeals have recognized vote dilution, they've required a point of comparison, and that the district court here said, you know, everybody who's a voter has equal votes. So it's unlike gerrymandering or malapportionment where you can point across a line and say, my vote's worth less. And so your point of comparison for your vote dilution theory is?
Is that it's not every voter in D.C. who's injured by it. It is only citizen voters.
So the point of comparison, it's the votes of citizens are diluted compared to what?
To the votes of to their former share of the electorate.
OK, so the point of comparison is the voter, the qualified voter pool before the law that you're challenging.
That's right, Your Honor.
So it's a temporal comparison rather than a geographic.
Yes.
That whole discussion is on the merits, though, correct?
Which discussion, Your Honor?
Discussion you just had with Judge Pillard.
That was about standing. I was addressing the merits previously.
I was asking about standing, and I took your answer to be that the harm is, you know, they're challenging the law and they have a basis to challenge it because compared to the situation without the law that they claim is unlawful, claim on the merits is unlawful,
right?
Their current voting power is diluted.
Yes.
And do we have a case in which that kind of before and after, as opposed to here and there, is the point of comparison?
The case cited in our brief about the non-resident voters voting in a city, non-resident property owners, that was decided, you know, in favor of the plaintiffs, even though it was a rational basis test that was applied because being a member of a...
Well, the Michelle case seems, the language in the opinion seems directly on point.
Our decision in Michelle.
Oh, Michael, yes. You certainly have that. I mean, that shows that it's not... what happened there is that each individual state voter's right to vote for a House of Representatives of 435 voting members was reduced equally. But they all had standing because they were all injured. But there were other voters in the country, that voters in D.C. had their votes expanded. They got to vote for voting representative.
Yeah, two standing questions in the case. One was the congressman, which Vanderjagt settled, and the other was the individual voters.
Yes.
That's why the case is quite analogous to this one. And the court held that the individual voters had standing in that case.
Yes.
Because their vote was being diluted.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's very similar to this case, and it shows the you know, what the law is in this circuit as opposed to, say, the Fourth Circuit.
And then how do you distinguish Daughtry versus Carter, which was the case of ours upon which the district court principally relied?
I would distinguish it as the plaintiffs failed to show that their vote was even diluted. They said it might be diluted, but it was too speculative. You didn't know when where these people who had returned were going to be living and whether they lived in plaintiff's districts and whether they would actually lose any voting share in any actual election.
And the district court said, well, I'm not relying on the speculativeness part of the reasoning. I'm just relying on the rejection of vote dilution theory in that case.
Well, I think the district court quoted the case right. It said that not every claim of vote dilution is a states in a claim for an injury, and that's true. I mean, they claim vote dilution, but they didn't show it.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of cases that claim vote dilution in which courts have said no standing, like the bunch of the voter fraud cases from the 2020 election, Bognett, Wood, Maryland Election Integrity. How do you distinguish the assertions of vote dilution as a ground for standing in those cases?
Well, I would just, one way to distinguish it is that some of those cases, like the Fourth Circuit one that was that the defendant put in supplemental authority, is should have been dismissed for failure to state a claim on the merits, because there is no right to have a perfect election, that and uh, and and that's what they were claiming.
But for purposes of standing, would we put ourselves in conflict with the standing analyses in those cases?
Well, I think in a way, Your Honor, it could have been dismissed on standing, but for a different reason, because the right claim is not legally cognizable.
The right claim, the correct claim?
Right, right. Because it's, you know, there was actual injury, even if very small. Their vote share was reduced by these unlawful votes, but that injury, in fact, is not legally cognizable, because if the court recognized such rights, democracy would grind to a halt.
Sounds a little more policy argument than a...
I mean, you couldn't have... Right, right. You couldn't have a, you know, perfect election, or you couldn't have any elections. No election's perfect.
Well, is it... Once the election is conducted, I mean, there they weren't challenging, as you are, facially a statute. They're challenging what they perceive to be failure to enforce, or the Supreme Court of, was it the Pennsylvania case, Supreme Court's decision, they said that should have been the state legislature. So in each of those cases, it's sort of a claim, yeah, that dilution is mixed in there, but that there should have been enforcement where there wasn't. So it does seem to verge more over into a citizen's concern that the law is not being applied. So it's more of the general grievance.
Right.
Is that part of your argument or not?
Well, I think so. They're alleging an illegality. They should have enforced it better. Shouldn't have allowed these illegal votes to be cast. But they don't have a right to...
the enforcement of the law.
They're not injured by the enforcement of the law because they don't have a right to a perfect election.
I was just going to say, what cases do you rely on specifically for the right to citizen self-government?
The main one is Foley versus Connolly.
Foley seems quite contrary to your position because it talks about it's permissive for New York to limit state troopers to citizenship. And in fact, you know, it's a limited category of jobs and...
Well, the reason it's hope that these statements about citizen self-government and the right to govern is reserved to citizens and so forth are holdings is that the court then goes on to say that the practical consequence of these principles is that these laws don't offend the Equal Protection Clause. And that's true. That's all the purpose that the court put to those principles in that case. But the principles that it used to decide the case to reach its judgment are still holdings of the court.
On your merits argument, is your substantive due process claim and your complaint the same as the claim you've developed more in your appellate brief about the constitutional right to citizen self-government?
Yes, I think the substantive due process claim is I did not concentrate on in the briefs here. It's because it relies on a right being deeply rooted and relies on history a lot. But there's other ways
for citizen self-government that you I mean, I take it that you're making this argument because in support of your position that were we to reach the merits, that strict scrutiny applies rather than rational basis review. Like that's what's at stake there is.
No, I don't think you do tiered scrutiny for a violation of a right like citizen self-government.
That's what I'm saying. So if you're trying to establish that right, because.
Because then if it's up or down.
It's fundamental right, and then it becomes strict scrutiny.
But isn't the
theoretical route to recognition of citizen self-government precisely the analysis provided by substantive due process?
No, because it's an unenumerated right that's not protected by implication in the due process clause, but it is a logical consequence of the Constitution.
So you're positing a separate category of unenumerated rights that we don't analyze through the substantive due process.
Exactly, like the right to privacy, Your Honor. That was big until recently, at least.
I thought that was analyzed through substantive due process.
No, I think it came out of a number of from emanations from various parts of the Constitution, including the Ninth Amendment. And the Ninth Amendment says that the existence of rights enumerated, protected by the Constitution in the Constitution should not be construed to deny or disparage other rights that may be retained by the people. And I would say other rights that, if they're real at all, are protected by the Constitution. The Ninth Amendment seems to indicate that there may well be other rights that follow from the Constitution.
And you're saying that we don't discern those through the substantive due process analysis of whether it's deeply rooted.
Those are some, because the Supreme Court has stated how you were supposed to determine those rights. But other rights that might fall from the structure of the Constitution, they might be presupposed by the Constitution because it's a blueprint for a democratic public.
They would presumably easily meet the substantive due process analysis, wouldn't they? Seems like that's very much framed to embrace just such rights.
I think it's deeply rooted in the nation's history because it is presupposed by the Constitution, and that the exceptions to it historically have been, well, especially early on, say Massachusetts didn't have an explicit citizenship requirement for voting. But John Adams, who wrote the Constitution, wrote in the Constitution that in this Massachusetts Constitution, using the term citizens and people interchangeably in the preamble. And it never says non-citizens can vote. It simply says that to vote, you have to have lived here a certain number of years and so forth. And at that time, nobody knew. There was no authoritative statement of who was the United States citizen. I mean, on July 2nd, 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was, or rather when independence was voted on, everybody in that room and outside in the country became an American citizen, but not, except for people, I guess, who were just visiting or who were British soldiers on American soil. And it remained unclear just who had become citizens for quite some time. So it was impossible for John Adams to put in a citizenship requirement, a U.S. citizenship requirement, into the Constitution.
You also argue that the law, the D.C. law, imposes a facial classification based on citizenship or nationality.
Yes.
Where is that in the text of the law? I don't entirely follow that line of argument.
Well, it did, they dropped the citizenship requirement. So,
okay, so that's taking away a line.
Right. And that means that non-citizens can vote.
Right.
And means that logically.
Under equal protection, we're looking at a classification.
Right.
And we're trying to decide, is this classification unconstitutional? And this law doesn't classify.
Well, it classifies
on national origin or on citizenship. It decides not to.
Well, if this law, right, but if this law is if, you know, you take the text of this law, it follows necessarily that non-citizens can vote.
Yeah.
So
citizens. So there's no distinction between the ways that they're treated.
Right. And I would say that that's on its face. I mean, just what it means is that non-citizens can vote. They might as well have said so. Because it does mean that, because it's impossible for that to be the law and for non-citizens not to be able to vote.
So the men at the Virginia Military Institute have standing and a equal protection claim subject to heightened scrutiny to argue that the women should not be part of the student body on that theory.
Because men are a protected class.
Yep.
And so the only thing that protects that is prevents that kind of lawsuit is the idea that it's not they dropped a distinction rather than making a classification.
That's the argument that I wanted you to respond to, because that's what DC argues that it did here.
Right. I think that even if they have a case, maybe they do have a case. It's just that it meets strict scrutiny to allow women. Mm-hmm. It serves a compelling government interest.
If we were to decide that this statute is subject to rationality review rather than heightened scrutiny, what's your strongest argument that you nonetheless prevail on the merits?
There's no interest the district could claim that can overcome a competing or countervailing compelling interest in preserving citizen self-government and the sovereignty of the people.
But the presumption of the question, just hypothetically, is if we didn't accept your fundamental right to citizen self-government argument, then you can't smuggle it back in by saying, well, that's a compelling interest, right? So if we say that's not a compelling interest, that's not a fundamental right, but nonetheless, what I'm looking for is any argument, and you, this may not be your case, I didn't see this in the brief, but that it's irrational or doesn't even meet the minimal level of scrutiny.
Well, it's irrational to, there's no argument for why illegal aliens are permitted to vote. The whole thing is irrational.
They do make an argument that they say if people are working here, paying taxes, sending their children to school, they're in a practical sense part of the community, that there's an interest in having people be, you know, engaged and feel that they belong. So, and what I'm looking for is on if we assume rationality review applies, what's your response to why that's not a rational basis?
Well, I would go back to saying that even if there's no right to citizen self-government, the Supreme Court didn't hold that there was. It certainly held that there was a powerful interest in citizen self-government.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, Brian Leach for the Board of Elections. I'd like to pick up Judge Pillard with a question that you asked of my colleague about this point of comparison idea. And they have pointed to, as you know, as my friend acknowledged, a temporal comparison before and after. Now, the cases in which vote dilution has been recognized as a cognizable injury for Article III purposes involve situations where there is a comparison in geographic space or comparison between groups within the same election. They do not recognize this idea of a comparison across time. Part of the reason for that, and this Judge Randolph goes to the point you made, you brought up Michelle. My friend didn't acknowledge Michelle, but I think that that case is quite distinguishable because there you have a derivative injury tied directly to a fixed legislative body with a set number of members at 435 by law. So there's a much easier path to finding a particularized injury to each individual voter and each individual congressperson. Whereas when you're dealing with a changing, ever-changing, diffuse general electorate, the point of comparison itself is essentially a moving target. There's no way to determine whose aggregate share of voting power, or as my friend put it, the aggregate share of the electorate any group might be experiencing. So in that sense, along with the point that my friend acknowledges that every vote is still getting equal weight, this would be a quite anomalous theory of vote dilution when every vote is getting equal weight. And the concept of vote dilution is, by definition, unequal weighing of votes.
But go ahead.
I was just going to say, was there any after testing, you know, the results of the election that non-citizen votes actually affected the outcome of the election?
I know how many they have. The board has kept track of how many non-citizens voted last election. I believe it was 480.
Do you have an updated registration number?
I believe it's 900. And I can actually do have the numbers here. 980 citizens as of January, non-citizens as of January 2025 are registered.
How many of them were illegal aliens?
I don't know the number on that, Judge Randolph. And the reason I don't is because the council made a reasonable judgment that it would be unnecessary for purposes of the district's goal with this law, which was to expand access to democracy at the local level, to make distinctions based on federal immigration status. It's also considerably easier for the board to administer when they don't have to sort through all the different types of federal immigration statuses. And so under rational basis review, those are entirely proper judgments for the council to make. But yeah, so I don't know the answer to that. But I would acknowledge as well that my friends are bringing a facial challenge.
You don't know it. Does anybody in the district board of elections know it?
I don't know, Your Honor. I apologize that I don't. But part of that is because the law by its terms is not drawing distinctions among non-citizens based on their federal immigration status. And my friends are bringing a facial challenge to the statute. So they have to show it's unconstitutional in all of its applications, not just as to potentially legal immigrants, but as to people who are lawful permanent residents, people with lawful visas. They haven't made that any sort of showing like that on any of their claims on the merits.
You pointed out that the plaintiffs allege that they're registered, but they don't allege that they have or intend to vote. I guess the question for you is, why is it necessary that they intend to vote to support their standing on a vote dilution theory? Can we infer that? And is the number of protesting non-voters that are registered, you know, something that gives enough weight to their votes?
Well, notably, my friends have not argued that you should infer an intent to vote. What they've attempted to do is submit additional affidavits attached to their reply brief and drop a footnote in the reply brief asserting new theories or new allegations about intent.
They claimed that their vote was diluted. Now, that doesn't imply or suggest that absolutely states they vote. I mean, how can you have a vote that's diluted or evaporates without voting? I mean, well, it necessarily follows from the allegations in the complaint, seems to me, that they've made a sufficient allegation of voting.
Well, I think it has to be more than just an allegation of intent or even implicit. It has to be a concrete plan, as Lujan teaches. It's not enough to just say, I intend to vote at some point in the future, even if they had said that. I think it had to be something a bit more, maybe a specific election. But
like what? Give me an example.
I think some of the allegations they put in their new affidavit, which are stated in the present tense as of January 25, they're not stated in terms of what they intended at the time they filed suit.
The allegations in the declarations are about voting in the past.
There are allegations. Yeah, yes. And there are
some before the statute was even passed.
Yes.
So I guess what you're saying is if you voted in the past, then we can infer that you're going to vote in the future.
No, Your Honor. There's more than the supplemental affidavits discuss not only past voting, but an intention to vote in the future. Now,
just saying it's too little too late, but that's exactly what they should have argued. This is a vote dilution theory, as Ms. Hall alleges in her declaration of January this year. I have voted for candidates for local offices in 20 and 22 and 24. I intend to vote in 26. And as Mr. Heller says, I voted in every presidential election since 1980, usually including voting for the local council members. And I plan to vote in the upcoming elections. And so your position is that's exactly what would have sufficed to raise their dilution argument, but it's too late because it wasn't in the complaint.
Yes, if they had alleged that in their complaint, they would have gotten past the imminence requirement. It would not have helped them when it comes to the particularization issue. It wouldn't have helped them with the generalized grievance problem, but it would at least make a showing or a plausible allegation of a certainly impending injury. Now,
in your memorandum that you filed is the argument that they didn't sufficiently allege that they were voters. Where is it?
I'm sorry?
Where in the memorandum that you filed?
In your briefs, you argued that they didn't allege that they had and will vote?
In the arguments in our brief, I don't know the exact page span, but it's...
I'm talking about in the district court.
In the district court. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have the exact page span of what our brief it was. I know we raised the argument below because they responded to it. The district court didn't address it. I can try to find it now. I apologize. But the argument I know was raised.
Was there any allegation in the complaint about?
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, was there any allegation in the complaint about intending to vote or how the vote was to be diluted?
There are allegations. There are legal conclusions about how the law would go about affecting the votes. There is no attempt at quantifying what the degree of vote dilution would be. There's essentially a legal assertion that the effect of the law would be to, quote unquote, dilute the weight of or dilute the, I should say, the voting power of certain groups or the citizens generally.
In this court, I think it's the red brief at pages 22 to 23 talks about on 23, plaintiff's complaint is noticeably bereft of any allegation that they intend to vote or run for office issue for elections. The complaint asserts nothing about plaintiff's intentions or plans to vote, doesn't even allege that they have ever voted in past district elections. And I think Judge Randolph was asking, did you raise that in
yes.
the district?
Yes, JA-26. I have the site.
JA-26 is where you raised it.
Yes, that is correct. The complaint has no allegations about intending to run in future elections, and the bare minimum they need to intend to vote, according to the precedent of the 8th and 9th circuits, which have addressed similar issues.
And does that matter? I mean, if these are Republican voters and they feel like Republicans never win in the district, why am I going to bother to go line up somewhere? Is the existence of registered voters who decide for reasons of futility not to vote, is that enough to raise a dilution theory?
I'm not sure it would be, Your Honor, but I would.
What if you were in a packed district and you're just, or maybe it's the inverse, in a cracked district? I have no, you know, if 100% of people who share my interest went out and voted, we would have zero chance. So I care and I want to bring a gerrymandering claim, but really I have to have done the futile thing.
Well, here's why you
say I would do it in the future.
Here's why you might not need to do that. There's two different aspects, if you will, to a racial gerrymandering claim based on cracking. One is the potential dilution of your vote. Now, if you don't intend to vote in the future, you may not have an imminent injury as to that. But the other component of it is essentially a racial segregation claim.
The stigma claim. But I mean, that's not true for the, like, if we look at Gill, political gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm. That is true, Your Honor. But I would say nothing really turns on anything like that in this case, because here there's not a claim of futility. But even if the court disagrees with us on this imminence issue, that's only one component of standing for them. And getting past that doesn't help them at all when it comes to the generalized grievance.
You argue that the power of plaintiff's individual votes was not diminished in any way. Really? I mean, what about the Michelle, our case, where it is about a change to the ability of territorial representatives to appear in the Committee of the Whole in the House? It's a before and after change. So in that respect, it's just like the change here. What the plaintiffs are challenging is a law that, relative to how it used to be, does dilute their votes.
The difference is, when we say there's no effect to the change of their votes, what we're acknowledging is the fact that they admit that the weights of their individual votes are exactly the same as they always were.
No, they're not. Because if you're, you know, I mean, just like with the representatives, being one of 435 versus one of 440, the vote of the representative after the inclusion of additional representatives is marginally diluted. So too, you add non-citizen voters, and after you've done that, your vote is, relatively speaking, diluted.
In analyzing claims that involve expansions of the general electorate, what courts have looked to is the fact that it's different. There's a difference between the weight of your vote and your share of the electorate. Now, acknowledge there are cases where the line can be fuzzy, but there is still a line, and it's one that makes sense. When you're dealing with expansions of a diffuse and ever-changing general electorate versus a change or adding of non-members to a fixed legislative body. But I do want to, if the court has any questions, I'm happy, you know, we're comfortable with the merits. If the court believes that there is standing here, we set out in our briefs why we don't think that's the case.
You said that there are cases about the differentiate between expansions of a diffuse and ever-changing electorate versus those that, you know, take a particular number and add a particular number. What do you, which cases are you thinking?
Well, Michelle is really the only one that I have found that involves the same type of fact pattern. And it's a highly unusual fact pattern tied, I think, to the unique context of legislator standing, which has a long history. There's been a lot of water under the bridge since Michelle. But in cases involving expansions of the general electorate, I mean, we have this court's decision in Daughtry. And I do want to take that case up because I think my friend has missed part of it. He's right that part of it deals with concreteness and speculativeness. But there's a critical part. There's a third leg of the stool with Daughtry, which is particularization. And this is in the sentence in the decision leading up to footnote 27, where the court says these plaintiffs don't have standing in part because they haven't shown that their votes are disfavored vis-a-vis those of some other group. And it borrows that vis-a-vis language from Baker versus Carr, which is referring to unequal weighing of votes in the same election where you have a fixed geographic location, malapportioned districts, to draw this comparison.
Would a voter have standing if, because of redistricting, they were placed in a district that had 10 times more people than the one that they were in? Would they have standing then?
Not if their proportion of representation corresponding to that district remains, if there's still a one person, one vote breakdown between the districts, I don't think they would have standing because there hasn't been a dilution of their vote.
Are you familiar with Westbury versus Sanders?
I'm only passingly familiar with that case, Your Honor. It hasn't been discussed in the briefing, so I believe it involves congressional redistricting.
Held that they, because their vote would be diluted by being placed in another district that was more populous, that they had an injury that was sufficient for standing.
Well, taking that to another level, if you had more non-citizens in the district than citizens, and then we go with your logic about the votes are still counting the same in terms of the same weight, would then that be a different scenario?
So I want to take the I apologize, Your Honor, for not knowing about Westbury. I will take Your Honor's word for it that standing was found there. I do think
you don't have to take my word for it. If you take a look at Michelle interpreted Westbury exactly the way that I put it.
Okay, well,
go ahead and
understood.
Answer the question.
Yeah, I understand, Your Honor. I think I may not be understanding the hypothetical, the facts of Westbury, but if you're taking one person from a roughly equally apportioned district and putting them in another district that just simply has more people, is how I understood the hypothetical. I'm not quite sure that, at least at the state level, that would be, if that's how I'm...
This is from Michelle. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that voters standing to challenge practices that are claimed to dilute their vote, such as being placed in a voting district that is significantly more populous than others. See Westbury.
Is that right.
Wrong?
No, Your Honor, it's not wrong. But what it's referring to something else. It's referring to a comparison between two different districts where they have different levels, they have the same level of representation, but different numbers of voters. And that's what creates the unequal weighing of votes, because the person in the less populated district, their vote has 5 or 6 or 10 times the power of the people in the malapportioned district. So that's an entirely different situation, because here the votes are weighing equally. But to pick up Judge Childs with your hypothetical, in that scenario, I still don't think there would be a vote dilution claim of injury on standing. There may be a different theory of standing, or there may be a different party that could bring a suit. There may be a candidate that could bring a suit. There may be a political party that could bring a suit based on either an organizational theory of diversion of resources, or a candidate could bring a standing claim potentially on a competitive injury. But for purposes of vote dilution, if the votes are being counted equally, the governing law suggests that there is no Article III injury in that context.
You're still hanging on that there's a generalized injury here. But you also, in response to Judge Randolph's question earlier, when we were talking about the 980 voters that you can't kind of segregate out, you know, based on who's non-citizens versus citizens, there's data points there to let us know this, that if there is some other type of injury.
I think that's right. But I think that's just a limitation on the facts of this case. If I'm understanding your hypothetical correctly, in the other situation, there just may be other types of claims that could be brought. But the fact that we don't know, I think, is further evidence that we don't know there's an injury that's been alleged.
Okay, so for right now, as to standing, you're hanging that there's no allegation in the complaint about the intending to vote or how the vote is diluted or any allegations about running in future elections, therefore generalized grievance of standing.
I might just amend that somewhat.
Okay.
The lack of an intent to vote in the future and the lack of an allegation about running or concrete plans to run goes to imminence. That's an independent basis. They haven't alleged an imminent injury, but the injury they've alleged, even if it is imminent, is a generalized grievance that is not particularized to them because it's shared, as they admit, by every citizen in the district or by every citizen voter in the district.
Okay, and then on the citizen self-government, help me out there because that term is not utilized a lot through the cases. And so is that forfeited also because not raised before the district court specifically?
Our position is that that theory of standing, that argument as a theory of standing has been forfeited because it's not, it was not argued below as a theory of standing. Now, we acknowledge they alleged a cause of action with that idea. I understood my friend to concede that the citizen self-government theory of standing is essentially equivalent with their vote dilution theory. If that's the case, then it's probably before the court and there's no difference between the theories of standing. They are the ones that on appeal that kind of reframed it. Either way, though, it still is a generalized grievance for the reasons set out in our brief and as I've explained. On the candidate standing, though.
But you do consider there to be such a claim?
No, no. We on the merits? No, I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood the question. No, they are asserting a right. But they, in order to trigger strict scrutiny, that right, they have to show it is deeply rooted in history and tradition. Here, they have marshaled no historical evidence to support the idea that citizens since the founding have had this unenumerated fundamental right to exclude non-citizens from participation in local elections. They acknowledge the history cuts against them, and they simply say that they try to flip the burden back onto the district or the Board of Elections to show that the history supports non-citizen voting, but the burden is on them under Glucksberg to show that this right is deeply rooted in history and tradition. The burden is not on us to disprove that point. The fact that they acknowledge that the history is at best unclear, we would submit it's quite clear, but their theory is it's unclear. That's essentially an admission that they can't prevail on the merits because Glucksberg, I think if you take it seriously, and the courts reaffirmed it in Munoz most recently, historical equivalence, it means that plaintiffs lose in a fundamental rights case. I don't think you can establish a deeply rooted right without a robust historical record supporting the claim that you're bringing. And so.
So you're, to go back a little bit in your argument, you're saying that the plaintiffs have waived certain arguments with respect to standing if they didn't raise it in the district court. You have strong support in this circuit for that proposition, but I've never understood the rationale behind it. If you didn't raise any objection to standing in the district court, have you waived it?
No, jurisdictional objections.
Right. So the court has an obligation to decide cases only when it has jurisdiction, but there's a corollary, and that is the court has to take jurisdiction when it has it. And so I don't know why only the party opposing jurisdiction cannot waive any argument, but the party asserting jurisdiction can. It seems to me not to make much sense.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think it does make sense in this respect. I think it's rooted in the presumption that federal courts presumptively lack jurisdiction and that the burden is on the party asserting or invoking the court's jurisdiction to affirmatively show it does exist. And the court should only exercise jurisdiction when necessary. And so if there's an argument in favor of jurisdiction and the party with the burden to invoke and show that affirmatively a jurisdiction exists, if they don't make that argument, I think it's a fair matter of procedure. And
if they make the argument in the district court and you're the defense counsel and you don't respond, have you waived? Have you waived any objection to jurisdiction? The answer is no.
Right. But I think that's
your argument. If somebody raises it in the district court, if you don't respond, you've waived the response. It doesn't wash. It doesn't wash in exactly the situation I'm talking about.
Well, I realize there's an asymmetry, but I do think the asymmetry is rooted in the asymmetry of Article 3 itself, which
I
is
think
that
I'm wasting the court's time because
on the merits,
it's an uphill battle.
Why is it administratively easier for the board to have a voter registration system that doesn't take into account whether someone is a lawful, you know, is a lawful documented versus an undocumented?
It is administratively easier because it is often quite difficult to sort through different types of and different statuses of federal immigration law. And if someone is coming in and they have, if the board is not necessarily equipped to be able to decipher out immigration fraud on the spot when it's registering people.
Is there not such a thing as like a green card?
I'm sure there is, but there are also fraudulent immigration documents that the board is not.
Fraudulent, you know, IDs for citizen voting as well. And so one could have some kind of requirement that you have, you know, what is the ID now? The one, whatever, the real ID or I don't know that. And it's, I guess another way of putting it, is it rational to allow undocumented people who are not present legally vote?
All of those arguments, I think, would be persuasive if this were a heightened standard of review. And even under rational basis, I don't think there are, but my friends haven't made them. They have forfeited entirely any argument that this law does not pass rational basis review by not arguing it.
Convicted felons can vote in D.C., can't they?
They were re-enfranchised in 2019, yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
2019, was it?
That's my understanding, yes.
That is people who are serving a prison term or people who have served the term?
I believe it's people who have served.
So they're people who are presumptively back as full members of society with their civil rights having been restored.
That is my understanding, although I as I stand before you, I'm not 100% sure about that, but I assume that that's correct. But to go back to what your Honor raised, fair points. If this were a situation where we had the burden to show it was rational by some colloquial measure, I think that would be those would be arguments we would have to grapple with. But no one has raised them in this case, and the burden is on plaintiffs to show it, to show not just that it's irrational, but to negate every conceivable justification for the law, even at the pleading stage.
Does the fact that the act was passed for the purpose of enfranchising non-citizens make it subject to heightened scrutiny because it has the purpose of discriminating against citizens or American nationals by diluting their vote?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Why not?
There is no plausible inference of discriminatory purpose simply by enfranchising felons. And the reason for that is that the law, first of all, they have disclaimed reliance on legislative intent in their complaint at JA-13. They say legislative intent is not necessary because they think this is facially discriminatory. They're wrong about that. I think as the colloquy you had with my colleague shows, the law is facially neutral, but they've disclaimed any argument about that. They point to no well-pleaded facts in their complaint on this point. But the more fundamental legal point for why their claim fails is that the courts do not impute a discriminatory, invidious intent to the legislature simply because a law has an effect on certain members of the population, even when it might appear to be inevitable, particularly in a case like this where you have non-discriminatory rationales for the law. So if you take a case like Feeney, for example, you have a situation where there was a veterans preference hiring, right? And everyone acknowledged it had an inevitable disadvantage for women because of historical gender disparities in the military. And nevertheless, the Supreme Court recognized that, well, it does have this unfortunate effect, But we're not going to infer discriminatory intent because this is a legitimate law. It has other legitimate purposes. And so we're not going to draw this inference of discriminatory purpose simply because of its effect. Arlington Heights lays out a number of factors that go into the showing of discriminatory intent. My friends have not taken up any of them, particularly when you view this in light of the presumption of legislative good faith. There's really no basis to infer that there was animus towards citizens. To provide a few examples, Judge Randolph brought up the fact that felons were reenfranchised. I don't think anyone would infer from that discriminatory animus against law-abiding persons. If the district were to lower the voting age, I don't think anyone would infer that there was animus towards
the elderly. Once you register to vote, do you automatically become not eligible, but required to serve on juries?
You do not, Your Honor. My understanding is that the statute governing jury service still requires citizenship.
Still have to be a citizen to serve on a jury.
That is my understanding. Yes, Your Honor.
If we were to reach the merits of the Equal Protection Clause claim, does your position that the act removes a voting classification mean that plaintiffs have failed to state any equal protection claim, or does it mean that the act is subject to rational basis review?
It's subject to rational basis review.
And why? If there's no classification, is it subject to rational basis review under the Due Process Clause, or is it subject? Where does the Equal Protection Clause even have bite?
Well, I can only follow the doctrine of the court on this point. Conceptually, I'm not quite sure why you would go to rational basis review. It is a bit of a formality in many cases. I think it derives from the equal protection component of the due process clause itself. But when the statute is facially neutral, I'm not aware of any court simply ending the analysis there. There's usually an analysis of rational basis, maybe as a backstop just to ensure that there is nothing wholly irrational in the law. It could be in certain as-applied claims, there could be an irrational application of the law to a particular person, even though it's facially neutral. Now, we have nothing like that here, but I think that's why a court might proceed to the rational basis.
And if we were in rational basis territory, do we apply the standard test and ask whether the law is rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest, or the somewhat modified version that courts looking at non-resident vote enfranchisement cases use, looking at certain factors to determine, is the newly enfranchised group, do they have a substantial interest in the election, or is that just an application of rational basis?
I think
it seems that have a little more bite.
Yeah, 2 points. I think the outcome in this case is the same either way. I don't think the court needs to worry about that, but I see Your Honor's point that I don't know that it has more bite, this rationality when it comes to looking to the interests of those who have been enfranchised. I think it could just be a particular subset of the idea of rational basis review. Certainly, if you're enfranchising people with no legitimate interest in a jurisdiction, then it could very well be it's irrational. And my friend acknowledged the Brown case from the Eastern District of Tennessee involved that type of fact pattern. Now, that was entirely different in this case. It involved non-residents, fragmentation of voting, a thinly veiled effort to perpetuate decades of racial discrimination. Here, every person gets a single vote. Only residents, and this is important, only residents with fixed residency in the district who have disclaimed the right to vote in any other country have the right to vote in the district under this new law. So there are still limitations on which non-citizens qualify.
All right.
Thank you.
No more questions, I think.
Thank you. We would ask the court to affirm.
Now, did Mr. Hayek reserve any time? All right, we took you over. We gave you more time than that on the primary argument, but we'll give you the 2 minutes for rebuttal. If you want it, you don't have to take it.
Yes, Your Honor. We did state below that we had standing because our the plaintiff's right to a citizen self-government was violated, and the violation of the constitutional right is an injury. And
you said that for purposes of standing.
Yes, for standing. We said that below.
That was the same vote dilution harm.
That it was. We did allege that separately in below that the we had standing because our rights were violated. The right to citizen self-government was violated. We also said the right to citizen self-government implies the right to vote in an election in which only citizens vote. And that's on at pages 16 and 64 through 68. And we cite those pages in our brief. Defendant never responded to this argument. So if anybody forfeited it, it was defendant. And the court, I think, passed on it by treating it all as vote dilution. And we previously discussed that, Your Honor. This is also not a general grievance, it's important to point out, because not all D.C. voters are injured by this law. Only citizen D.C. voters are injured by this law. Non-citizen voters have been benefited by the alien voting law.
What about I found it striking that this is a case about vote dilution, and there's nothing in the complaint saying that these are people who ever voted or ever intended to vote. That's really problematic, and I wonder why, once that was brought to your attention, why there wasn't an effort to amend the complaint in the district court.
If somebody goes to the trouble of suing, or if someone's public-spirited enough to go to the trouble of suing over their voting rights, they're either going to go to the trouble. It can be presumed that they're either going to go to the trouble of voting or that it would be futile.
People have all kinds of programmatic interests that don't support standing to sue. I mean, that's a really central part of our inquiry. You could imagine.
It also follows from a claim of vote dilution, Your Honor, that you intend to vote if you're claiming that your vote's going to be diluted. And also, there's a statute that allows defective jurisdictional allegations to be amended in the trial or appellate courts upon terms, which is Congress's way of saying that it doesn't.
What are you referring to? I don't recall that being cited.
Yes, we cited in the statements. In the statements in this court, Your Honor.
The statements?
The declarations of plaintiffs, Your Honor.
The declarations attached to the reply brief?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's Congress's way of saying that it's not right that defendants can't waive standing, but plaintiffs can.
Any other questions? All right.
The
case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.